On Sunday, November 12th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents guitarist, composer, and the subject of Emma France's film, Bill Frisell, A Portrait, which will be screening at Doc NYC. Join us as we have a brief discussion with the filmmaker Emma France and profile Bill Frisell. That's Sunday, November 12th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. To WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. And our guest for this evening, well, we have a few. Our main focus is Bill Frisell, and we'll be talking to the director of a documentary that will be featured at Doc NYC, and we'll also be screening in December. Emma France is the director of Bill Frisell, A Portrait, and we're going to open the program with a plea for assistance for the survivors of Hurricane Maria from blueswoman Alexis P. Souter. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, starting now.
What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar.
My name's Joyce Jones. I'm on the line with Alexis P. Souter, blues woman extraordinaire, who has an announcement for our Sugar listeners. Hi, Alexis.
Hey, how are you? Hi, everybody. How are you guys doing tonight? Well, you know, I'm trying to make things happen here in New York City to try and help our brothers and sisters in Puerto Rico. And we're giving a hurricane benefit at B.B. King's on November 21st, which is a Tuesday night. And it's two nights before Thanksgiving, so it's really a great time for giving and sharing and helping. And we have a great lineup. We have Vanessa Collier. We have Slam Allen, myself. We have Kareem Walks. We have all of these high-level players from the blues community. Also, we have a Latin orchestra, Javier Lewis. He'll be playing with his orchestra, representing Puerto Rico to the fullest. And we have the interdenominational gospel choir out of Brooklyn, a 40-piece gospel choir. It's going to be an evening of great music and great fun. We're going to have silent auctions. We're going to have raffles. You're going to have so much more. It's from 7:30 to 11:30, and I'm truly looking for people to come out and be joyful and giving and to help us to get this through.
Unfortunately, we can't mention prices on the air, but it is definitely affordable, and people should give what they can to support Puerto Rico and the Caribbean. And,
yes.
Coming to this event would definitely be a fun way to do that.
Yes.
So information about this event is on your website.
Again, my name is Alexis P. Souter. I want to thank Joyce for giving me this minute. And my website is Alexis P, as in Peter, Souter, S-U-T-E-R, alexispsuter.com. So that's alexispsuter.com. And thank you, Joyce.
All right, Alexis, okay. Thank you so much for sharing this great news. And y'all come out.
Yes. All right, Joyce. Thank you.
Peace.
Bye-bye.
Hi, my name is Joyce Jones. I'm on the line with
Bill Frizzell.
Bill Frizzell, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. I appreciate your spending the time with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I've wanted to talk to you for a long time, but part of the reason why I'm fortunate that I have this opportunity is that there will be a film, a documentary, Bill Frizzell, A Portrait, shown at DocNYC on the 15th of November. And I understand you're going to be in attendance as well.
Yeah, I'm going to come, and I guess there'll be a little question-answer time and stuff like that.
Right. So what was your reaction when Emma France approached you with the project?
Oh, wow. I mean, it happened so, like, spur of the moment. You know, I was actually playing, I don't remember how many years ago. It's getting to be a while ago now. I was playing in Austin, Texas, in the Continental Club. It's this really cool place that I love to play. And I just finished playing. I walked off stage and Emma walked up to me and said, "Wow, that sounded great." And she just sort of presented me with this. I didn't really have time to think. It was like she said, "I'm thinking about doing a film about you, and would that be okay?" And I just, well, you know, sure, okay. I mean, I was sort of surprised that why would somebody want to do a film about me? You know, I just made this quick decision, and then I guess I didn't realize what was on the horizon there. You know, it was then fairly quickly. I mean, it was real. She really was serious about this, and so within, I think it was pretty soon after that, she started showing up. You know, at gigs and on tour and at my house and all over the place
with a camera.
Number of years. Yeah, and it was like, wow, this is actually happening, you know?
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Emma Franz. Hi.
Emma Franz, hi. Thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. For those who are not aware, Emma Franz is a film director, producer, editor, cinematographer, writer, singer, songwriter. And Emma Franz is the director of Bill Frizzell, A Portrait. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. You just made me feel exhausted with that introduction.
Now, how did Bill Frizzell wind up being your subject for this film?
Well, I had been a long-time admirer of his music, and then I had had the good fortune of meeting him a couple of times through mutual musical friends. And there was one concert when I was listening to him in yet another situation, to yet another type of audience, yet another style of music, having heard him in many different contexts. And I was just looking at the faces of people, completely mesmerized by what he was doing. And that happens every time I've heard him. And I thought it would be really fascinating to try and capture some of the elements that make that possible. You know, basically some of the elements of high-level music creation and then what's unique to him, because he is incredibly unique. I mean, not many artists can play across so many styles and retain such a singular and important voice. And I similarly love that he is humble and gentle and he doesn't look for the limelight. All those aspects that I sort of seek out in music and musicians, and I just thought he would make a wonderful subject. And when I approached him and asked him if he'd be interested, the first thing he said was, "Oh, me? What's so interesting about me?" You know, in his typical humble fashion. So it was a good start. I mean, he'd seen my last film and enjoyed it and agreed, and then we just started and plugged away for over the last 8 years.
Now, your last film, just so the listeners know, that's Intangible Asset number 82?
Yes, that's right.
That also was about a musician, a drummer.
Yes. The themes were really about the sort of existential search, I guess.
Right.
You know, how a music practice enhances your own life, helps you understand yourself, understand others. You know, those fairly broad themes, but I wanted to find someone traveling with music, as I had been for quite some time, to try to create a narrative where people might feel that transformation rather than just talking about those sort of ideas. So a friend of mine who I'd played with for a long time in Sydney had been going to Korea trying to find a master shaman musician, and he was fascinated actually with this incredible complex improvisational language and how a shaman in his 80s could play for 3 days straight. So the energy. So I thought, well, wow, if we go and find him, that will be a wonderful example of how people from disparate, you know, walks of life can connect through music. And it turned out wonderfully because in the classic style of the hero's journey, it's the people you meet along the way, not really the destination. We met some incredible musicians and artists who, one of the singers had lived by waterfall for 8 years to be able to sing louder than the waterfall. He had this incredibly strong voice so that he could then sing these epic songs that were 8 hours long, you know, without taking a break. And so it turned into this wonderful journey. So the film is actually like a multi-perspective journey from all these artists that were involved, based around the hook of this Australian drummer trying to find a shaman musician, and how that in itself and his research about the music turned him into an incredibly unique improvising drummer. That's Simon Barker.
Cool. And how did that help? Well, did that help you working on that film, help you working on the Bill Frisell film?
It's interesting. There weren't many crossovers at all. I mean, they're completely different films.
Right. Well, he was saying that that process, once you got started, seemed to stretch about 10 years. Is that correct?
We felt like 10. It was actually, in inverted commas, only 8.
Oh!
Yeah, yeah. Actually, the time with Bill was spread over, I guess, the first 4 or so. Then I took a break for a while whilst I did other things and started to work on all the material because I had hundreds of hours. Then once I had a sort of rough cut, I started looking into which of the music I would have access to. And then a lot of the music license fees were very, very expensive. So I had to decide to recut the film. And in the end, it ended up being mostly Bill's compositions, which I think is also a good thing. I mean, it's wonderful to show the scope of what he does, but sometimes maybe people forget what an incredible composer he is as well.
I've got to say, I appreciated the way you told the story. This is a beautiful portrait. Bill Frisell, Portrait is the name of the film, and I have a great understanding upon watching the film, and it helped me in my conversation with him and how I would approach him. It was wonderful.
Oh, it's great to get your feedback. Thanks.
And you edited as well, did you not?
Yes.
Oh, wow. That's a beautiful job you did.
I love editing, actually. And I think it's a very musical process, editing. So I quite enjoy that stage.
So this film, on November 15th, will be showing at the Cinema Sinopolis, I think it's called.
Yeah, in Chelsea, anyway.
Exactly. As part of the Doc NYC Film Festival. Yeah. That's going to be wonderful.
I hope everyone can get to see it.
I neglected to mention that we're talking to Emma Franz from Melbourne, Australia. You'll be making your way all the way here to New York City.
Actually, right now I'm in Barcelona, but I've got to go to London and Milan before I get there.
Wow.
Which sounds all fabulous and exotic, but so it's really just a bit of work, but it's quite fun, you know.
Yeah, all that travel sounds like a bit of work indeed.
Yeah, I think that's why I've got a bad cold right now.
Well, thank you so much, Emma, for sharing this time with us and sharing this film with us. This is definitely a wonderful piece of work, and I hope more people see it and learn more about this project. Thank you so much for it.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it, Joyce. Thank you.
still seems kind of like, well, why me? You know, there's not a lot of, well, not yet. They haven't dug up a lot of juicy dirt on me or anything like that. And, you know, I haven't spent much time in jail or nothing, you know. So I'm thinking, why are you so interested in this? And it turns out that she's just really into the music, you know.
Right.
And in the end, you know, and then it was this long process. There were years that literally, I think it was about 4 years that we would meet up in different places. And then there was another long period. I mean, that was happening long enough that I was wondering, wow, what's going on here? When is this going to end? And but then there came a time when it all stopped and she went away. And then I thought, wow, that was weird.
I guess she was editing at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't understand the process. It's sort of like, I can understand it like when I make an album, it's sort of like, I guess making a film is like, it's that similar process, but multiplied by 100,000 or something, the time that it takes. So then these more years went by where nothing really happened. And then suddenly she appeared again and there's the film and it's all finished. And so, but it's wild, you know. I think came across to me in the end was, you know, I keep saying why me or why, but I think what I feel so good about is she really was into the music, and it's more about the process that it could have been on somebody else too, you know, just the process we go through to try to get something done with music. I really appreciate, she really put a lot of love and care into it. And she's a musician herself. So
right.
I was really happy with the choices she made with using my own music in the film and the editing of the music. And so I'm happy with it.
Well, of course, you've seen the film, I take it.
Yeah. But I didn't see it. That was the other thing. I was thinking, oh my God, what is going to happen? You know, because I had nothing to do with the putting it together. So all I did was spend that time with her. And then I didn't know what she was going to do with all that.
Right.
So I saw it when it was already completely finished, when I saw it for the first time.
Well, I saw it recently, and I really do appreciate the work that was put in and the care that went into it and her detail in outlining this portrait of your life up to this point.
I hope I still got a couple more, little more to go.
I suspect you have quite a lot to go, which was something that was outlined in the film, how prolific your writing is. Had you been writing all along? Was that something that when you went to school, was that something you wanted to do? Was that something you did before school or?
Well, maybe still the guitar, even now the guitar is kind of my focus, but I mean, in a way the guitar is like a magic wand for me, for just music in general. And by the time I went to Berklee School of Music in the 70s, and when I was there, I had been playing guitar long enough that I sort of, not that I ever have it together, but I could basically play the guitar. So the classes I took were mostly arranging and composing, and that was what my focus was. But I was trying to apply it to the guitar. It was maybe around that time that I started to actually write more. And then when I got out of school, wasn't too long before I started trying to make my own bands and stuff like that. But it was during that time in the 70s, I guess, where it started to, writing became more important. It's hard to draw the line between playing and writing and composing and improvising. And when I write something, it always has something to do with who I'm playing with. And that line between what I write and what the band plays is blurred quite a bit, which is, I love that. I mean, I count on that. When I write a melody, I want to hear my friends play it.
Right.
And see what they do with it. It's not like I have a fixed, I want to have it be something that's really not predictable or fixed. I want it to be alive.
Well, that definitely explains why this type of music, to use the phrase jazz, really works for you.
Yeah, that's definitely, you know, that's when I was in high school and I discovered it. Again, I hate to use these names for things, but I think that's the only way I know what to call it. But that's where that was happening. It was like, that was the place where you could, it's just anything was possible.
Right. I've read that you, to take it back, were born in Baltimore and grew up in Denver, Colorado. Is that correct?
Yeah, we moved to Denver when I was just a baby. But then I would go back to Baltimore. My grandparents were there, and that's where my mother was from. So I'd go back there like every summer, usually.
What would you do there? What was the music like for you just between the two?
I mean, that was, well, really, I was so young, and it was so different, the atmosphere there from Denver, you know. I just have these, it's more like this sort of these dream memories of being there with the heat and the humidity and the, remember the tar on the street bubbling up, and I would take the, was it a cable car or the trolley car, you know. I mean, it was amazing thinking back. I remember going with my brother alone downtown Baltimore to go see a movie, The Music Man. I don't know. It's just, you know, I was young. So then my grandparents, by the time I was, I don't know, 11 or 12, I probably didn't go there so often anymore. So
most of your musical memory is in Denver then?
Yeah, which is not known to be the jazz capital of the world. But then looking back, there's just incredible stuff going on that when I think of how lucky I was, the high school I went to, you know, it was like right in the middle of the city. So it was Denver, like a lot of places, it was segregated. It just, that's the way it ends up, you know. There's this part of town and there's that part of town and there's the other part of town or whatever this is. But the school I went to was like right in the middle of, I didn't realize how amazing that was. I took it for granted at the time, but it was just the most amazing combination of people there, you know, from everywhere. And this is in the 60s, and it's, I still carry this with me. I don't want to get too much into this, but I think I was spoiled by, I took something for granted that seemed normal to me, that I went to see Martin Luther King speak at our church. And,
wow.
You know, I grew up playing with people. It's wild. Oh, this is embarrassing too. Like, as I'm getting older, these sort of award things start happening. And it's actually right after this film happens, I'm going to Denver and they're doing this Colorado Music Hall of Fame thing. So I'm being inducted into that.
And all right.
The other people that are being inducted into this thing are, there's Diane Reeves.
Oh, who, yeah.
She went to actually the rival high school of mine, you know. But then there's also Philip Bailey.
Yes,
and
from Earth, Wind, and Fire.
And Andrew Woolfolk and Larry Dunn. They were all schoolmates of mine, you know, at East High School.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we all went to school together and played in the concert band together, you know. And then there's also, I think his name is Charles Burrell. He was the first African-American to be hired by a symphony orchestra or something.
Wow. So
his bass player in Denver, and I believe he's Diane Reeves' uncle, or he's about 100 years old, something like that.
Oh, wow.
And Ron Miles will be inducted, who's one of my closest kind of musical brothers. And into that Hall of Fame, they're also inducting the music program at East High School, where I went to school. And so I guess what I'm saying, I didn't realize at the time how amazing it was that I was even there. By the time I was in high school, I think I already knew that all I really wanted to do was play music, but I was a terrible student. I wasn't into being in school at all. I just wanted to play.
Right.
But I did play in the band, and I still carry with me that feeling of community. And then looking back at the, you know, there's so many unsung, amazing musicians that are playing all over the place.
Sure.
And how the music community there in Denver would, I'm just barely learning how to play, and I'd go to a club, and the older guy would invite me up to sit in or all that kind of stuff. And then as the years go by, I realize all this stuff that happened in Denver that I had no idea, that they said that was where the first gig that Elvin Jones did with John Coltrane or something.
Wow.
You know, or there was a club that Miles used to always come to. I mean, that was before I even knew that stuff was going on.
Sure.
But just as I get older, I realize there was more happening. Pretty soon after I got out of high school, I knew I had to get out of there. But there was maybe more going on than I thought.
Thank you.
Well, I noticed when you mentioned Elvin Jones, you actually recorded with him. You got a chance.
Yeah. I can't believe that. I mean, some of the things that, again, thinking back, like when I'm in high school and I become aware of some of this music, and I never would have, in my wildest imagination, you know, some of the people that I've gotten to play with, it still doesn't seem real to me. Yeah, I did get to play with Elvin Jones and a lot of other people too.
Sure. Actually, I have this recording in my hand that you did for Nonesuch on that label with you, Dave Holland, and Elvin Jones.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's amazing. Did you record with Elvin Jones anymore, or did you?
No, okay. No, and I shouldn't say unfortunately. It's just amazing that I got. It was really just for that recording, and then we had actually talked about going back in the studio again, but it never happened. And this was a little bit towards the end of his time, you know.
So. Okay. Wow.
Yeah, it was just incredible just to spend a little time with him. You know, I just feel like what a gift. You know.
Is there somebody that you're listening to right now, guitarist? That, you know, you think everyone should be listening to?
Oh, man. That's such a hard question. There's so much stuff happening so fast. I don't know. I think what happens with me, maybe I have to break this habit, but, like, I don't listen to as much music as I would like. And when I do, like if I have a pile of CDs, my tendency is to go towards if I see a Charlie Christian CD, I might gravitate towards that. Or, right. You know, it's
people who came before you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's things about, like, just talking about guitar, like somebody like that, every time I revisit just that one person, Charlie Christian, every time I go back and listen again, I'm just like astonished. It's overwhelming. It just continues to keep revealing things that I had no idea were. I mean, I liked it when I first heard it, but then it's one of those things where it just keeps on sort of giving me little clues or like a key to open this other door. I know that would happen with younger people too, or newer people or whatever. I almost hesitate to mention even one name because then I'm leaving out. There's so many people now too. The music is really, I feel, you know, every once in a while I get discouraged with the computer. It's like nobody knows how to play anymore. But then there's always somebody doing something amazing. And, you know, like I mentioned, Elvin Jones died and Paul Motion died and Jim Hall died. And but it just blows my mind the way the music just keeps on, like what these people have done, the way the music is passed on. It's really like I've gotten so much, what the right word is, comfort or reassurance or something, that I keep hearing, like I'll hear somebody, I don't even know their name, some young person, and then in that I hear all that whole history coming through that person, and it's like, wow, it's like people, we don't really go away somehow.
Yeah, nice.
It's kind of great.
Well, actually, it was mentioned in the film that you came to New York to study with Jim Hall, and it was really great that Emma was able to get him before the transition.
Yeah, I'm so thankful. Yeah, there's a lot of that also in the film. Just I treasure those moments with Jim or also with Paul Motion.
Yes.
Like there's this scene in the film at the Village Vanguard, which it's the last song of the last set that Paul's trio played at the Village Vanguard. You know, those are the last notes we ever played as a trio, and they're actually in the film, you know, which is like, wow.
Yeah.
She actually got that, you know.
And what they contributed to the film, Jim Hall and Paul Motion and even John Abercrombie.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. Now, is the Village Vanguard like your New York club home?
I mean, that's another one of those places, like, I just never would have dreamt I'd ever get it. You know, that was the first place I went when I first came. It was the summer of 1969.
Wow.
I just graduated from high school and my parents moved from Denver to South Orange, New Jersey.
Oh.
So that summer I came with my parents And the first place I went was the Village Vanguard. So that was the first time I was there. And then I went there so many times. That first time I saw Gary Burton there. And then soon after that, I saw Mingus and Dexter Gordon and Sonny Rollins and
wow.
Elvin and Ross on Roland Kirk and Lee Konitz and on and on and on. And I saw so much music in there. Again, it was, I would never get a chance to play in a place like that. But that was right around the time also that I took these lessons with Jim Hall. That was incredible. That week, I took a lesson with Jim Hall, and he was talking about Sonny Rollins. This is like 1971, I think. And Sonny Rollins was just coming out of one of his retirement times and playing at the Village Vanguard. And so Jim's talking about, yeah, Sonny does this and Sonny does that and listen to how he does this. And he just happens to be playing at the Village Vanguard. So, man, to hear Sonny in the Village Vanguard, that was one of the thrills of a lifetime. So then years and years and years go by, and Jim was like, I couldn't believe that. After I took these few lessons with him, and then it was maybe 10 years later, I was walking down the street on 6th Avenue in the Village, and I see him, and I say, oh, wow, there he is. I got to say hi to him. And I said hello to him, and he remembered. I couldn't believe it. He goes, you know, I was just some little kid that took some lessons, and he remembered me, and I sent him some music that I'd been doing, and right away, he was like, wow, this is incredible. You know, he was so supportive, and pretty soon, he called me for a gig, and that was at the Village Vanguard. We did one duet concert first, and then I played with him at the Vanguard, and that was the first time I ever played at the Vanguard was with him in, I don't know what year that was, in the, I guess, later 80s or something. And then eventually I could play there with my own band and then with Paul and stuff.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar Mubble is the name of this program. Our guest for this evening is guitarist-composer Bill Frisell. And Bill Frisell is also the focus of a documentary that will be screening at Doc NYC. And since that's sold out, it will be screening in December at IFC, from what I understand. What you're listening to in the background is Jim Hall Frazzle from his release Dialogues. It was a 1995 Telarc Records release. Jim Hall on guitar, Bill Frisell also on guitar, Scott Coley on bass, and Andy Watson on drums. Before that, we heard Smilin' Jones from Bill Frisell, Dave Holland, and Elvin Jones. The name of the release is Bill Frisell with Dave Holland and Elvin Jones. This is a 2001 Nonesuch Records release. Bill Frisell on electric guitar, acoustic guitar, and loops. Dave Holland on bass and Elvin Jones on drums. Before that, we heard It's Nobody's Fault But Mine, Bill Frisell's Savoy Jazz 2010 release, Beautiful Dreamers. Bill Frisell on guitar, Rudy Royston on drums, and Ivend Kang on viola. Before that, we heard Old Time from Bill Frisell and his 2011 Savoy Jazz release, Sign of Life Music for 858 Quartet. The 858 Quartet consists of Bill Frisell on guitar, Hank Roberts on cello, Jenny Scheinman on violin, and Ivan King on viola. Before that, we heard Small Town, which is Bill Frisell's latest release with Thomas Morgan. It is a duet from their ECM release, Small Town. Bill Frisell on guitar, Thomas Morgan on bass, and we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, from The Very Best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. This is a 1998 RCA BMG compilation, which was originally recorded in 1967. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams. Many thanks to Emma France and Alexis P. Suter. Go to alexispsuter.com for more information about the fundraiser. And more from Bill Frisell on Sugar in My Bowl on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Jazz fans, this is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for November 12th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's show features guitarist Bill Frisell and a preview of Emma France's documentary film, Bill Frisell, A Portrait. The film starts a run at IFC Center in Greenwich Village on December 6th, and Frisell himself will be at the Jazz Standard from December 7th through 10th. And we'll get to our shows of the week in a moment, but we'd like to thank all of you who pledged during WBAI's Fall Fun Drive and give one last nudge to any of you who've missed it. We'll have details at the bottom of the segment, but first we start with saxophonist Gary Bartz, who's at the Blue Note on November 13th and 27th with pianist McCoy Tyner. Vocalist and pianist Diane Shore is at Birdland from November 14th through 18th. Pianists Mark Carey and Randy Weston and bassist Reggie Workman are all at the Schomburg Center for the National Jazz Museum in Harlem's annual benefit concert on the 14th. Drummer and percussionist Bobby Sanabria leads the Multiverse Big Band in an educational concert on the history of Latin jazz, and that's at Jazz at Lincoln Center's studio space on the 16th. And they return for West Side Story at 60 Reimagined, and that's at JALC's Dizzy's Club from the 27th through the 29th. Blues vocalist Alexis P. Suter is at B.B. King's for a Hurricane Maria benefit concert on the 21st. Vocalist Dee Dee Bridgewater is at the Blue Note from the 21st through the 26th with a release party for her new The Memphis Tour album. Saxophonist Kamasi Washington is at Terminal 5 on Manhattan's Far West Side on the 22nd. Pianist Mark Carey is at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem on the 29th, and he'll be playing the music of Duke Ellington. Bassist Christian McBride leads the Tip City Trio at the Village Vanguard from the 28th through December 3rd, and he returns with Inside Straight from the 5th through the 10th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. And if you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. If you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The support WBAI link on our website will point you to all the details, and we'll be really grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our bi-weekly schedule, we're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and are scheduled to be back on air on Sunday, November 26th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
And I mean every word of it. Thank you.
to go back to high school. Now, you were playing clarinet, was that it?
Yeah, I played, starting in fourth grade, I started playing clarinet in the school band, and then I was in sort of a community youth marching band thing, and like the clarinet was more like this thing that I kept doing it. I did well at it. You know, I was always like the first chair in the band you know, and stuff like that. And I played in the all-city band or all-state band and orchestra and all that stuff. But I don't know if my heart wasn't ever fully all the way in there somehow. It was more like an intellectual. Somehow I looked at the notes and I pushed the right buttons down.
Right.
And I wasn't like I was really hearing it.
Or
guitar,
feeling it.
Yeah, and with the guitar, that was something I picked up on my own a few years later. And that's what I just was drawn to. I didn't even read music on the guitar till much, it was like a completely different part of my brain was working. Mm-hmm. And the guitar was what I played with my friends, and it was more like a social, you didn't have to tell me to practice the guitar. I just went there, and that's all I did was mess around with it.
Yeah,
that's kind of what I've been doing ever since. But there was a point where it just got more, later in high school, my band director, he gave me a Wes Montgomery album, asked me if I could learn this song for the talent show. These girls were doing this dance routine to Wes Montgomery's Bumpin' on Sunset. And they were doing it with the record, and they would dance around the stage. And the band director said, man, it would be so much cooler if this was like actually live music instead of them doing it to the record. And I'd never heard Wes Montgomery before. And that was a major mind exploding thing there. And I tried to learn this thing and played it with my friends at the all school show. And that was sort of the beginning of this, me entering into whatever it is I'm in now, I guess. I don't know.
Well, thank goodness for Wes Montgomery.
Yeah, man. It was the perfect song at the perfect moment. It's like this tipping point between, you know, I was into whatever you call it, pop music, rock music, R&B, blues. Mm-hmm. You know, at that point, I was really into blues, and I played in a, sort of a, like a soul band where we played like James Brown stuff and Temptations and all that kind of stuff. And then I heard Wes Montgomery, I heard that one song, and it was like this, it was enough of relating to what I knew and showed me the way into this whole world that I didn't know anything about. And when I think of how much music was coming at everybody during those late 60s times, it was just hearing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. And then within 3 or 4 years, I'm listening to Miles Davis and stuff like that. It's like, wow, it's crazy how fast the stuff was coming.
I noticed Miles Davis comes up a lot when I'm reading about you or even watching the film. Miles Davis is a name that's really up front. What is your connection to, if you could put it into words, Miles Davis?
Well, again, there's so many of these guys that were like this larger than life role model hero. Yeah, just he quickly, if I go back to the Wes Montgomery thing, on that Wes Montgomery record, there's Ron Carter playing bass. Mm-hmm. So then the next thing I do, I sort of look at the album cover, and then I go to the record store, and then I see, and I'm into guitar, so I say, oh, there's a Kenny Burrell record in that. That has Ron Carter on it. Or there's another Wes Montgomery record and has Herbie Hancock and Ron Carter. And then, oh, wow, there's a Miles Davis record that has Herbie Hancock and Ron Carter.
Right.
And then there's Wayne Shorter, and then there's da-da-da. You know, you just start following the thread of this stuff. And then when I heard Miles, and then again, you go back. I feel so lucky. I'm old enough that there were a few of those Miles records that I actually got to hear them right the week that they came out. You know, when Miles Smiles came out, or Miles in the Sky came out, and then when In a Silent Way, and then Bitches Brew. And like, you could see the whole history moving from day to day somehow. And Miles, I think a lot of it is, of course, it's his sound. Or I mean, when I think of him, it's almost like I don't even hear the sound of a trumpet. I hear the sound of music or something. Mm-hmm. And so much of him was about the context that he would put himself in, or the way his groups, I mean, I think that affected me more than almost anything, was listening to the way his bands listened to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like hearing Herbie Hancock and Tony Williams and Ron Carter and Wayne, and the way they would, like that band, the way they, well, so many of his bands, but that one for sure, for me, it's like the level of human beings interacting with each other. It's just, I don't know if anything's ever been on that. Will never cease to astound me. Anytime I hear that stuff, it's always like, oh my God, back to the drawing board, or just it's like this impossible to reach standard, you know.
Thank you.
Well, there is a way that I notice the way you listen and interact with Joey Barron in particular. It's like, oh my goodness, my partner and I were watching the film and we were noticing just the way you exchanged and interact and had so much fun doing it. When did you come across Joey Barron and why are you still so tight?
Yeah, he's another one of those, like, just brother. You know, I had been in Boston and then, you know, I went to school at Berkeley and then I went to Europe and then I finally made it to New York, you know, and I'd been in New York a couple years and Joey had been in Boston before I was there. So I didn't know him then, but a lot of the people that I knew in New York were there's this guy, Joey Barron. He's out in LA, but I guess he had gone to LA from Boston. And actually he went out there to play with Carmen McRae. That's what he wanted to do. And he ended up playing in her band.
Nice.
And then he also did gigs like with Al Jarreau and Lou Rawls and stuff like that.
Wow.
He was in LA before he came to New York, but there were a lot of guys that I had known in Boston that were then in New York, and people were saying, oh yeah, Joey's coming back. Joey's going to move to New York. And so I've been hearing about him. Really, the way we connected, I can't remember if I tell this story in the film or not. There was this recording session that we both were on, and it was very chaotic. There was like a lot of people, and the music was, you couldn't really hear each other, and it was a difficult situation. And we were sort of far apart, like Joey was in a booth kind of far from me and I'm across the room. The music was just sort of not really connecting. And but there was this one moment where he played one backbeat. He just went bap like that on the snare drum. And it was like in the most perfect spot to connect everything, the most badass place in the beat or whatever it was. And he played that and I looked at him and it was like we were the only two people in the room that were, and we just smiled at each other.
Wow.
And it was like, oh, okay. We got it. Like we knew or something. It was like this thing. Then he said, hey, do you want to come over to my place and just play? And so I started going to his apartment and we just play duo stuff, just free. It was just like talking, having a conversation. Mm. It just was so great. And then when I finally, I don't know when, a couple years later, when I actually had the confidence to try to make my own band, I called him. Closest guys I knew were Hank Roberts playing cello and Kermit Driscoll playing bass and Joey. And that was my first band, so.
there was one group that you were with, Power Tools, Ronald Shannon Jackson and Melvin Gibbs. I guess it just happened because you were all in the city, but what?
Well, there's a guy, David Breskin. I don't know if you know him, but it was around that time in the, I guess, very early 80s. He was living in New York, and he was mostly known as a writer. He wrote for Rolling Stone and I think the Village Voice, and he did a lot of interviews. I remember at the time there was really great interviews with Wayne Shorter, and then like there was an interview with even like with Michael Jordan, stuff like that.
Wow. You know?
But he was really into music. He still is, and he still produces records. I first met him. He had worked a lot with Shannon, and he had produced a bunch of Ronald Shannon Jackson's records. And through Shannon, he knew Vernon Reid. And he actually got Vernon and I together, and we did an album that was like in 1982 or 81 or something like that. You know, it was like a duet record. And then it was a couple of years after that that he had this idea to put me with Shannon and Melvin. And it was really this guy David's idea. So, well, I barely met Shannon. You know, I'd seen him play a bunch, and I was with James Blood Ulmer. He's another one of my, that I need to mention him. When I came to New York at that time and I heard Blood Ulmer, that was another one of those mind rearranging. It's like I almost had to rethink. It had such a huge effect on me hearing him. Even to this day, every time I hear him, I was at this thing a couple of weeks ago and I saw him again. And I was like, man, there's nobody, not one person on the planet that plays that way. I was going to check out those guys a lot. So I think I might have just said hi to Shannon once, but basically it was for that recording was where we really met. And we rehearsed a couple times and we did the recording. And then later we did some gigs in Europe. At one point they were going to release this concert for the BBC in London or something, and I don't know whatever happened with that.
Well, when you mentioned James Blood Ulmer, though, I wrote this question quite some time ago, and I was like, I don't know if you have any relationship with it or not, but has Harmelotics influenced your playing or composition? Does that mean anything for you?
Well, then, Ornette Coleman, oh my God, that's getting into the heaviest. I'm almost scared to talk about that. You go back to the West Montgomery, and then one of the first jazz concerts I went to, now I'm really taking all this connection thing, but actually it was the second jazz concert I ever went to see was to see Charles Lloyd.
Oh.
And in the band was Keith Jarrett, and Ron McClure was playing bass, and Paul Motion was playing drums.
Ah.
So right there, that's kind of a what in the world? How did I end up? I've been playing with Charles Lloyd now, and I played for 30 years with Paul. And again, I never would have dreamt that. So then I go, I hear that concert, then I hear Keith, and I like, wow, who? What is this? So I go buy a Keith Jarrett record that has Charlie Hayden and Paul Motion and Keith, a trio record.
Yes.
And then there's Charlie Hayden, and then pretty quickly there's Ornette Coleman.
Yes.
And, you know, Ornette, it's the same, anything I was saying about Miles, same thing about, I don't hear a saxophone, I hear it's like a sound, and it's like the way his bands play together. You know, that's just, again, it's another too large to even find the words to, I can't tell you how strongly I feel about the impact that still has on me. Just thinking about him right now, it's like I become, I can't even talk about it, you know, and so he just becomes this, again, it's this something just that I look up to that I can never get to, you know. So then here's this kind of wild story. When I left Boston in 1978 and I went to Europe for a year, and that's where I met my wife. And soon after I got there, I had just very recently met the woman that is now my wife. She worked in a jazz club. It's a classic, you know, blah, blah, blah story. You know,
and fortunately,
she's a waitress in a jazz.
Fortunately, she's featured in the film and she's a visual artist. Yay.
Oh, yeah. So it was just, I don't know, like very soon after I arrived there, I'd never never seen Ornette play live before, and I was talking to her about how much I loved Ornette Coleman, and then it turned out there was this jazz festival, the North Sea Jazz Festival, which at the time was just starting up, really. It became probably the largest jazz festival in the world now, but and it was large then. So Ornette is coming to the festival, and I was like, man, we got to go. I just have to go see him. And so he was playing in the daytime. We were going to drive there. It was a few hours drive, but we left sort of in the middle of the night so we could be there in the day to see him. I was so excited. Wow, I get to see him. And he was playing in one of the really big rooms. It was a early version of Primetime. I think it was Shannon was playing and Bern Nix, and I think it was James Blood Almer. You know, they were really far away, and he was wearing this, like, kind of purple suit. And it was really wild, and it was sort of echoing through this thing, and it was like, you know, I hadn't really heard his electric music. This was sort of the first of hearing that group for me. It wasn't the Don Cherry and that band, you know, and it was great. You know, I was flipping out. I was like, wow, I was like coming from another planet or something. But he was really far away. I could barely see him, but I was just really thankful that I got to see him. So then I saw him, and then I went out and I saw, like, Oscar Peterson play, and then I saw Stefan Grappelli play, and then I think I saw Anthony Braxton or something. I'm walking around, and it's in this big kind of convention center place with all these different rooms everywhere and big, big open hallways with just mobs of people. I went and got a Coke, and I'm drinking the Coke, and right in my face, just right in front of me, there's Ornette Coleman. He says, "Where'd you get that Coke?" And I just said, "Oh, over at that, right over there." And I was like, "Whoa, what was that?" I just talked to Ornette Coleman. I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
That was incredible. So that blew my mind, right?
Sure.
But then this is where it gets a little more crazy, and I swear to God, I wasn't high or doing any drugs or anything. Probably a lot of people were in there, but I swear to God, this is true. Then I went and I heard some more music, and, you know, I'm getting kind of tired. And so I go, there's like a stairwell, and there's so many people. It was getting to be kind of a drag with that number of people there. So I found this doorway that opened into a stairwell, and there weren't any people in there. So I just opened the door and I sat on the stairs just so I could rest. And I'm sitting there, and there's like a knock on the door, and I open the door, and it was Ornette saying, "What's back here?" And I was like, "I don't know." And then he just went away again.
Wow.
So I talked to him twice, right? I couldn't, amongst, you know, there's like thousands and thousands of people. And somehow there was, I don't know if he just felt how much I loved him or something. That was kind of crazy. I'd feel a little funny talking to him. I mean, I always tell my friends that story, but I haven't said it too much. It's almost like some sacred, I don't know. And then years and years and years go by, and then I got to meet him briefly at a festival. And then a few more years go by, and then my friend John Rogers, a photographer, started bringing me over to his place in New York, and I got to play with him a few times at his place. And one of those times was just the two of us just playing. And that was, you know, I just can't believe how. And then I did one gig with him in London as part of this big festival thing. But those moments that I got to spend with him at his apartment were like, just, again, I can't put into words what that was like, just being with him and stuff. So,
wow.
Yeah, that whatever Harmelotics is, definitely had something to do with me.
Wow, nice.
Is there, because I know certain musicians have a particular instrument that they sort of, and you may have already told that it's happened. Is the drum the thing that you click in with, or are there other?
Oh, again, it just depends on who it is.
Okay.
It's more about the person, but definitely there's something about the drums, or like, that's some real heavy thing there. I don't know what it is, you know. Definitely, that's where if something's going on with that, that's what I feel like it just unleashes. It lets me, gives me the, again, you keep saying that the keys are opening the door or something, but there's definitely something with the drums.
There are two people that I want to bring up, and one of them is Phyllis Oyama, who, thank you very much, Phyllis, for helping to make this happen. And Claudia Engelhardt, who...
Oh, yeah.
When I saw in the film that she's the woman, the person who goes around and makes sure that you sound great in these environments, I mean, where did that idea come from? Is that your idea, or was that the company that...
Oh, no, I mean... We first met another band that I was playing with back around the, some of the time you're talking about with Shannon and all that was Naked City.
Yes.
And it was the very sort of beginnings of the Knitting Factory and all that. And
okay.
The first Knitting Factory when it was the Knitting Factory.
On Leonard.
On House.
Oh, that's right.
And Claudia was, I met her there. She did sound for Naked City. And then again, it was around the time I started doing my own gigs and I asked her to come with us, and that pretty much was that. Ever since then, it's more than however long this is. I just don't know. It's like 30 years or something.
Plus.
Yeah, I mean, she's been, you know, again, she does the sound, but it's just like she's in the band, you know, mm-hmm. but she does all this other, like, tour managing and all that kind of, you know, just she takes care of everything, really. And I'm completely spoiled by, like, when she's around, I just sort of follow her and everything works out, you know.
Yeah.
The level that she's in the music, she's in the music as much as anybody's in the band. It's like her vibe has a lot to do with her attention is there in the music all the time. And it kind of blows my mind to think that it's been going on that long and in whatever kind of circumstances, whatever kind of band I'm with or whoever I'm with, she's just always there. And she comes from a really musical, you know, her father builds metal percussion instruments.
Wow.
His name is Pete Engelhardt. You've probably seen his instruments around, these welded metal things that really, they're almost like sculpture, beautiful things that, and he played piano. And so her household, when she was a kid, there were always musicians. Or like she spent time in Brazil, and they're real close with Aerto and Flora and a lot of Brazilian. She was real close with Don Cherry. Again, talking about Ornette again. You know, Ornette would be at their house, or she recorded some albums of Don Cherry's.
Wow.
And she used to work at Keystone Corner in San Francisco. That's how she got started when I think she was still in high school, and she knew she wanted to do sound and
amazing.
Went to Keystone Corner, and she just always knew that that's what she wanted to do. And there's so many people she knew from the Bay Area. Their house, a lot of musicians would stay there. Her mother used to be Cecil Taylor's manager for a while and stuff like that.
Okay.
There's a lot of music going on with her family.
Now, there are a couple of things I want to mention before we finish up. One of them being this article that I found. It's like Artists in Conversation, a bomb. It was something that was written in spring 2002, a conversation between you and Mark Rebo.
Oh, yeah.
And I mention it only because both of you were around the New York music, quote, music scene. I don't know what to call it. But that period when things were really hot and there was a Knitting Factory. Do you have a relationship with Mark Rebo? Do you play together?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was just when I mentioned Blood Ulmer.
Uh-huh.
Mark called me. It was a benefit for... Oh, man, this is terrible. I can't remember the name of the organization that helps musicians.
Jazz Foundation.
Yeah, it was a benefit for that. And Mark asked me to play. There was sort of a guitar segment of the program. And there was Mary Halverson.
Oh, yay.
Who's definitely one of the people I would mention.
Excellent.
If you would say the younger, I just love her and Blood and Nels Klein and me and Mark were all the guitar players that were. So, yeah, Mark, you know, I've met him so long ago and, you know, we have done different things off and on throughout all these years.
Beautiful. You mentioned Naked City, though. That was a band that John Zorn, speaking of that period, put together. And it's addressed in the film as well. And it's sort of like both you and Joey Barron are like, okay, time to go. You want to share about that band?
Yeah, I mean, that was amazing. You know, it was like, again, it was this sort of, it could only happen at that moment. Mm-hmm. And with those people, like, you know, it sort of came to an end, and then a few years went by, and we did, I guess it was two gigs we did that were sort of a reunion thing. And it was like, wow, this is, how did we do this? I mean, it was cool, but it was definitely, there was the time and the place and the whole energy and everything was just, was about that moment. And, you know, I was doing a lot of different things with John prior to that, like mm-hmm. improvised things, or we were doing a lot of things in the studio with larger groups and duo gigs or these game pieces. And I was doing all this different stuff with him. And then he had this idea to make a band, like a small functioning group that could touch on all those different things that he was into. And so that's really what it was. Like, you know, it was his thing, but I learned so much from that. And, you know, I'm still doing a lot of things with him too, but nice. It's not like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's different music, but he's such a close friend, like family type. It's amazing how these things over these long spans of time, the way it develops and it changes and everybody's growing and going in different ways. And you go out on this limb and then you come back and you meet up again. And there's certain parts about getting older that are cool.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, another thing I better say, that your wife's name is Carol, because we said your wife, and, you know, that's just not right. You're both in Seattle, right?
Well, we just moved back to New York.
Hey!
Like, after 28 years being out there, we came to our senses. No. No, we literally just, as I'm sitting in the midst of a whole bunch of unpacked boxes.
Oh,
right
I
now.
Love it. That's great. That is great. So we in New York should be able to see more of you when you're here.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm still traveling like crazy. Yeah, it feels so good to be back. I mean, I would spend so much time here anyway, but it does feel like coming back home or something now. It really feels so good.
Yay. Good to hear. Do you have a steady group? Because you do so many projects.
Oh, well, it's like a whole bunch of groups, I guess. Mm. Like I'm going with this. It's just a string group. It's Jenny Scheinman playing violin and Avon King playing viola and Hank Roberts playing cello and it's guitar. So actually the first project I did with that group was with the man I mentioned, David Breskin,
yes.
who did the Power Tools thing. We did a project, music I wrote for this Gerhard Richter paintings. That's a whole another story, but the group started with that project, like, when was that? 15 years ago or something. And then we just kept on doing it as a string group. Right there, there's like Hank was in my first band, and Avon, you've seen him in that film with
yes.
Rudy Royston. And
yes.
Well, you can sort of see in the film, I guess there's all these different people that I play with at different times, and they've all played with each other. Mm-hmm. And it just feels like a family of
sure.
musicians that I play with, and sort of changes and evolves all the time, but then there's always some sort of common, there's a lot of history all the time too with mm-hmm. the threads.
I also noticed you're working with Kenny Wollitzen, the drummer, and Tony Shear. You still doing that?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, a lot. That's ongoing.
Excellent. The Haydens.
Yeah, and then I'm playing with Petra.
Yes.
And I played with Charlie. And
yes.
I met him through Paul
Motion.
Paul introduced me to Charlie, and then I have gotten to play with Charlie. And, you know, Paul would always be talking about Charlie has these triplet daughters, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'd be hearing about them. And then when I finally met Petra, it felt like I'd already known her or something. It was wild. Like, again, that's another long, I think when I first met Petra is coming up on, man, I don't know. It could be almost 20 years ago now or something. And, you know, we've done just different things throughout. We made a duet record quite a number of years ago, and then we just keep doing stuff off and on. And, you know, she's on my last album and stuff like that. So.
You know, when I actually found out that you two did things together, it was at the memorial tribute to Charlie Hayden.
Oh, yeah.
And that was amazing. All the triplets were there, and including Josh. You did a number together.
Yeah, that was great.
So please come to see Bill Frisell, A Portrait, if you can get in, because it'll probably be a packed house.
Emma really did an amazing thing. And
that T-shirt from Jim Woodridge, was that his... was that his you? You were wearing it. Was that his sort of envisioning you or something? Or that was just some character?
Oh, I don't... No, that's one of his character... Frank, I think that's what that T-shirt was. Yeah, he has a whole series of stories with that Frank character.
Oh, okay.
And he did that, you mentioned the Elvin Jones, Dave Holland album.
That's his artwork.
Jim did the, yeah.
Oh, and another person looking at that right now, Lee Townsend. He was a producer.
Yeah. He's married to Phyllis, actually.
Okay.
Phyllis Oyama.
Yes.
And he's been it's another long, long, long relationship. I met him when he was working at ECM Records in the 80s, and Lee produced my first band record for ECM, and then later became my manager, and he's produced not all of my records, but lots of my records, and many, many. He's another one of my, it's like these angels that are, you know, you're talking about Claudia and Phyllis and Carol and my parents and all these people, these sort of angel people are looking after me somehow.
Excellent.
I don't know how. I've been really lucky with all these people along the way. Whatever my band director who gave me that Les Montgomery record or my parents or, you know, I've been unbelievably lucky with people sort of backing me up all the way. Just haven't had that many people trying to beat me down, you know, so I'm kind of spoiled.
Well, I've got one last question because I have to ask everybody I talk to about this. Labels, record labels, is that of importance to you? Does that matter as much as it used to?
I mean, that's what I've been lucky again. Like I've always had, I did a lot of things on ECM in the past. And I still do. Yeah, that's another sort of long, over this long period of time that's still there. Think about how that label has survived through all this sort of crazy up and down and in and out of everything. And then for a long, long time, I was with Nonesuch.
Yes.
I mean, 20 years, I did, I don't know how many albums for them. And then Savoy, I did a few albums. And now, I'm working with them.
Okay.
It's really, we're in some other, I don't understand what's going on with the business. You know, with the computer and the internet, it's just sort of all happening too fast for me to grasp. But again, I've been so lucky to have that. I've been able to record as much as I've been able to. And so lately, I've done 3 albums. Actually, I've done 4. There's one that's done that will come out next year. But
nice.
So I've got these guys backing me up. I don't know. And
excellent.
I know that's not always the case.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Bill Frisell. I really appreciate the time that you spent with us. I am so grateful.
Well, no, it was great talking to you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you
Couldn't
so much.
Keep my mouth shut.
Yay!
All right. Well, I hope I'll see you around town.
Yeah, or at the screening, the upcoming screening.
Oh, cool.
Q&A.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for getting the word out about that. That's great.
Thanks so much, Bill. Take care.
Okay, bye.
And you're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. And what you're listening to in the background is from Michael Gibbs and the NDR Big Band featuring Bill Frisell. Play a Bill Frisell set list. This is a 2016 Cuneiform Records release. Before that, we heard from Power Tools, The President's Nap was the name of that song. Strange Meeting is the name of the Antilles New Directions 1987 release. Ronald Shannon Jackson on drums, Bill Frisell on electric guitar, Melvin Gibbs on electric bass. Before that, we heard the title track from Look Out for Hope. That's a Bill Frisell Band from his 1988 ECM Records release, Bill Frisell on electric guitar, acoustic guitar and banjo, Hank Roberts on cello and voice, Kermit Driscoll on bass, and Joey Barron on drums. Before that, we heard Monroe from Bill Frisell, Ron Carter, and Paul Motion. The name of the release is indeed Bill Frisell, Ron Carter, Paul Motion. This is a 2006 Nonesuch Records release. Bill Frisell on guitar, Paul Motion on drums, and Ron Carter on acoustic bass. Before that, we heard the continuance of Frisell Frazzle from Jim Hall's 1995 Telog Records release, Dialogues. As mentioned, Jim Hall on guitar, Bill Frisell also on guitar, Scott Coley on bass, and Andy Watson on drums. Stay tuned, La Nueva Alternativa is scheduled to air next. Sugar My Bowl will be back on November 26th. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.